Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. This is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So, Sam, the Mueller report is finally finished, although it's not out. Last weekend started with the first piece of news that there wouldn't be any further convictions, and the president and his allies quickly claimed victory, calling it a win, and many in the media quickly joined in that conclusion. And then a long wait ensued, and Sunday night, late afternoon, Attorney General Barr released his summary of the findings, saying that Mueller didn't find enough to indict on a conspiracy to work with the Russian government to sway the election. And then the second part, he said that Mueller laid out the case for obstruction and the case against obstruction, but didn't reach a conclusion. And then he took it upon himself to explain that there was no obstruction. There was no obstruction of justice. And that was not much of a surprise. You'll remember that Barr, I think last summer, wrote a memo to the Department of Justice saying that he thought the whole obstruction case didn't make sense to begin with. And that's where we are. People are angry. No one has actually seen the report. Everyone is making comments about the report. The president is going after the investigation. He is clearly gearing up for the 220 campaign around this issue. And Democrats are either angry, demanding the report, or falling over, feeling deflated about the findings. So that's where we are, and that's where we start our conversation. How are you?
Great, Julian. Just great.
So what what did you think? I watched the news. I commented on the news, nothing surprises me, but it was remarkable, remains remarkable to the day we're recording, which is on Tuesday, how much conversation can be had about a report that no one has actually seen except the Attorney General and Rod Rosenstein, and the kinds of conclusions that are being made from a pretty murky letter, to be honest, are pretty remarkable. They're not surprising. The Republican spin machine was in full gear. But I think a lot of commentators, reporters, journalists, they have basically echoed what came out of the Department of Justice.
I think it's easier to BS people when you don't have information. And if you're, the way I'd put it is this, it's easier to bloviate if you don't have any information. And if you're habitually in the mode of giving interpretations that where the facts don't matter, then not having facts is really disinhibiting. And so at some level, doesn't it strike you that allies of President Trump, such as Barr and Rosenstein, specifically Barr, and also all of Trump's allies, they don't need a report in order to reach conclusions. It's actually perfect circumstances for them to talk about how everything is fine and how the president is exonerated, because anyone who would care to take the opposing view lacks the information to say, no, that's not true. So I've been fascinated by this because there was this mania, this rush to on the part of seemingly by news commentators to go ahead and repeat what Barr had said. And I have to admit, I don't understand it, because my understanding is that under normal circumstances, there are things that ought to happen when a special counsel provides a report. And I don't think those things have happened yet. So just to give examples, the fact that there are no further indictments at the end, well, my understanding is that there aren't supposed to be indictments at the end because it's the end and Mueller is supposed to be reporting on what he did and what he's been up to these last several years. So my impression is that that is non-informative in the sense that that's what routinely occurs at the end of a special report. And then as far as the report itself goes, Julian, you're a scholar of presidencies and failed presidencies. If I understand correctly, I believe I was reading about Watergate, and I think that the usual procedure would be for the special counsel on a matter of such gravity to then refer things to Congress for them to look at. And so I'm a little bit confused about why we are taking at face value the conclusions of an attorney general who is hired explicitly to be a loyalist. So how is it that it's sort of the inverse of the Saturday Night Massacre, right? Like instead of firing someone for being insufficiently loyal, you hire someone because that person is guaranteed to be loyal. And so I just on the merits, I don't really quite get where anybody gets off making a lot of statements in the news about how the president may or may not be exonerated. I think we don't know.
Well, we don't know. And I mean, first, if you look at what we know, which is just little tea leaves, one, it does seem just from Barr's own account, and we assume he is loyal, that the Russians did interfere with the election. And that is what Mueller found. And so this already contradicts a lot of what the president has been talking about repeatedly, including during the famous Helsinki press conference. So that's interesting on its own. The second part about, you know, the finding that we hear from Barr that they didn't find enough to conclude that there was any kind of conspiracy or collusion with the Russian government doesn't answer lots of questions. It doesn't answer why so many people were lying. It doesn't answer why there were all these high-level officials with contacts with Russian officials, including the campaign manager. Doesn't answer kind of how far Mueller went in finding what these contacts and the economic business deals, all of this, what it all added up to. We have zero idea at this point. And it's a lot to say that Mueller didn't say obstruction didn't happen. And this was the centerpiece of the whole investigation. That was actually the centerpiece. And he didn't walk away with the conclusion.
Well, wait a minute. We have to infer from what is being said by a loyalist. I think we can infer that evidently this report doesn't say that there was no obstruction of justice, because if it said that, that would be blasted all over the airwaves and there'd be PDFs sitting in my mailbox of this report. So evidently it doesn't say there wasn't obstruction. Evidently it doesn't say that there was no collusion, right? Because if it said that, we would be hearing about that too. So what we can be pretty confident about is that it does not make those statements. Because if it did, we'd be hearing about them, right?
I think so. Look, this is an administration. I think my take on this is the administration played this incredibly well politically. And you're right. The special prosecutor left a roadmap, from what it sounds like, which is what Leon Jaworski left for the Watergate investigation. And the idea is the House Judiciary Committee has a job to make what you will of the information that is there. Part of what we're seeing is a backlash to the independent prosecutor law. This was the law put into place in 1978 in response to the Saturday Night Massacre, and which expired after Ken Starr in 1999, when special independent prosecutors had a lot of power. And Starr, when he wrote a report on Bill Clinton, wrote this very lengthy, very focused and pointed report. And now we're back to where we used to be. So special prosecutors are reporting to the Attorney General, and their reports are much more limited. It's more an information and data dump than a story, which is what Ken Starr did. But the administration has reacted very quickly with every piece of information that came out this weekend. And again, you have an attorney general who said very clearly a few months earlier he didn't agree there was any case for obstruction. So it's not really a surprise. That's how he'll interpret it.
Right, but what I'm getting at is that it's the dog that didn't bark, right? So we can be certain that, you know, this is sort of like a little bit logic 101 for our philosophy undergraduates. If there is something positive for the president in that report, we would hear about it. Therefore, the contrapositive of that is we didn't hear about it, therefore it's not in the report. And so that's just, you know, I remember learning that when I was a lad, a stripling in geometry, which is if not Q, then therefore not P. And so I conclude that there is not information in that report that rules out collusion or obstruction of justice. It's something more vague. I guess the thing I'm curious about at this point is, can that report be subpoenaed by the House Judiciary Committee? Because surely...
Sam, why don't you think with the collusion? I mean, he does have that quote...
That there's not collusion.
Right.
So I have to admit, this. Okay, so you're right about that. That's a point that confuses me, because my understanding is that collusion, I think there's some question about whether it's a crime or not, right? And so isn't the question there whether it's something that's prosecutable and therefore within the range of what Mueller could do?
That is my understanding. Again, we have limited understanding and we don't have a report. The exact quote is this is a quote from the report. Yeah. The investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. End of quote.
Right. So, you know, what have, yeah. what has not happened? We didn't get it. There was not an indictment of Donald Trump Jr. There was, who else is not indicted? I've lost track of who's not indicted.
Jared Kushner. Or the president.
Right. So, and the president himself, although there's some, like the FBI guidelines are that you don't indict a sitting president. And so if Mueller's by the book and he's a traditionalist, then he wouldn't even go there. He'd just talk around the subject and just go after anybody around individual one and then stop short. So those are things that didn't happen. I don't know. I guess it's possible that maybe let me kind of get away from the law a little bit and say maybe the only people who really colluded with the Russians were the ones who were smart enough to do so. And so Manafort was smart enough to actually go looking for advantage and curry favor and pass information to Russians. And so he got into the soup. And, you know, remember back in 2016, not to put too fine a point on it, these guys weren't expecting to win the election, right?
No, right.
Right. Yeah. They were expecting to pursue advantage that maybe could be used for business purposes later on. Nobody on either side of the presidential race was expecting Trump to win. And so there they are playing their little patty cake games, you know, with the Russians and not necessarily thinking that it's going to lead to an actual win. And so maybe so I agree with you. Like if the one thing that's in the report is that there's no collusion, that's fine. I would say in regard to the obstruction of justice, pardon my saying so, but don't we already know that there was obstruction of justice because it was on our news screens and it was in plain sight? Like, I don't know. Like, just because it's not secret, I don't know. I think the guy shot somebody on Fifth Avenue and we all saw it.
I agree 100%. I think to say there was no obstruction is hard for many people to swallow just because they've seen him very openly try to obstruct the investigation and at several key points be very clear on why he didn't like this investigation.
He fired Comey.
And the idea that even if the original charge is not true, if it has been disproven, that doesn't allow you to obstruct this investigation.
Yes.
And I think for a lot of people that it just doesn't jive with what they've seen. And their bar is very clear in his report that Mueller didn't say there's no obstruction. And he laid out a case for both, it sounds like. And so I think, that, look, there needs to be a public report. There needs to be congressional, at least inquiry into what the report says. But from my perspective, and I'm curious what you think, I don't think the Democrats are going to have much of a stomach to pursue this much more.
So do you think they're not going to, so are they going to subpoena the report? I mean, can they do that?
I mean, they can subpoena their report, I believe. I'm not a legal scholar, so I don't know how that would play out. There's arguments they can ask Mueller to appear and Barr to appear before their committee under normal oversight power.
Right.
But politically, you know, this was clearly a blow to them, even if not fair.
Yeah.
It was a political blow, and I think there's a lot of chatter in the party now. Let's move to issues.
And now McConnell is, of course, blocking a resolution calling for the release of the report. And so it appears that everyone's reverting to a playbook of saying, okay, Mueller is no longer a force here. He rode into the sunset. And now that there are no threats of further investigation, of further action by Mueller himself, it looks like everybody's circling the wagons and attempting to bury this, you know, put a few nails into it and bury it.
And it's also a matter of time. It's the election clock, and we're already getting into the election season. And so I think a lot of Democrats are going to make a political calculation. Right now, you have a few months left till this is really underway. And I think a lot of them are worried right now that this took a lot out of the impetus to pursue this. I might be wrong, and if the report comes out and it has a lot of damaging information, it changes the politics. But I think this weekend really was a setback politically.
So the idea is that there's no political oxygen in it, and it's easier to get ticked off about the fact that the Department of Justice is not going to pursue protecting the Affordable Care Act. And so if we're thinking about what would lead to political advantage, the fact that the same attorney general's office, right, if I'm understanding this correctly, the Department of Justice is not going to defend the Affordable Care Act. And so the idea would be, okay, whatever may be the substance of what Mueller found, we have to keep on going and let's go do whatever, ACA or what have you. Is that the idea?
I think that's right. And clearly Speaker Pelosi has been there. She's been leery about pursuing any kind of impeachment. She did allow the multiple investigations to be launched, and they are underway. But I don't know how much capital she's going to put behind that, as opposed to focusing on the question of, are Republicans colluding right now to get rid of your health care, which is, in the midterms was a very powerful issue.
Also not a, that kind of collusion is also not illegal. It's called legislating, right?
Right.
It's called, you know, pursuing lawsuits. And so what, there's this whacked out judge who issued a ruling that nobody on any side of the legal debate thinks is normal, which is that somehow the entire Affordable Care Act is invalid. And now the Department of Justice says that they're not going to fight that. I have to say, that is amazing to me that they would not fight such a plainly far out ruling, right? Because even people who oppose the ACA have not gone so far as to say that the entire law is unconstitutional.
And what do you think the, so before we jump into ACA, just to stick with the Mueller report politically, where we're right before this weekend happened, from what you've seen, the public had been very supportive of Mueller and very skeptical about President Trump. Even if I'm correct, polls saying many Americans thought he had engaged in criminal activity. Am I right?
Yeah. So public opinion is narrowly, I believe, favors the idea that Trump engaged in criminal activity. Public support for Mueller had increased. He had achieved indictments and convictions. But it is also the case that these things have a shelf life. And even though the public was supportive of Mueller, look, he's no longer going to be in the news at this point. And so I think there's a forgetting time. And like, I don't know, what do you think is going to be the forgetting time?
Well, I think it
a
might
week, act, a month?
It might even be reversed, in that if the report is interpreted as saying he exonerated the president and that argument gains hold, Mueller's credibility can actually become a benefit to the president, meaning the president can now use it to say he thought I was clear. And take that all the way to the campaign trail.
I don't know, but getting back to my little if P then Q thing, if it was of
back to philosophy.
If just logic 101, if it was net positive to Trump for it to be out, therefore they would release it. They didn't release it. Therefore, it's apparently not net positive for the president. And so my the media studies aspect of this to me is fascinating, which is the willingness of reporters to go along with the idea that somehow there's something positive against the report in the absence of seeing the report. I know the shoe leather reporters I've met are not this credulous. Like if I BS them on something, then they come after me. So why is it that this is within the range of what national political reporters are willing to do?
It's PAC journalism. This is total PAC journalism. Oh, and you watch it, you read it, you everywhere from TV to Twitter, there is just this dynamic where some people, you know, pick this up as the conversation, the next person to write or the next person to speak repeats that. That right. becomes the conventional wisdom
and so
within
you would,
seconds.
Right. And so what you don't want to be is too far out from everybody else. And so it's kind of like there are these phrases that professional reporters often use. So, for instance, they'll say things like so-and-so's out in front on that story. But they don't say like so far in front that they're doing something entirely different. That's considered weird. Or, right. So like that's more like something kind of far out. And so the idea of being out in front on a story means that you're within sight of everyone else. It means that you're paying attention to all your colleagues. And so basically all these reporters are is professionals plying their craft. They have internal standards within their field. Within their field, they know which things are acceptable statements to make or to not make. And right now the average of their opinion is that this is a setback for Democrats and that maybe there was not obstruction of justice. And so if we get too far out away from that, then we're saying something a little bit odd. We're far out from where other people are saying. So they're not any different from any other profession where, look, people in my field we say sort of similar things. And if somebody says something pretty weird, then that's considered heterodox. And yeah. So reporters are just like any other field of
endeavor. They've also been subject to a barrage of attacks from this administration, incessant attacks on this particular story. And people have been fired for getting things wrong. They've been discredited for the kinds of mistakes we always see in journalism. And so my sense is that when different reporters saw this story, that many were probably, fearful of moving too far off the conventional wisdom and being wrong because the report seemed to play in, even though it really didn't. Barr's summary of the report play into the allegations the president has made, which he instantly repeated about fake news, et cetera, et cetera. And I think this is a result of the environment the president's helped create. He has journalists on edge.
Does this happen in other countries? Like when they write about
I'm sure it's even worse.
When they write about Brexit, I thought that reporters in the UK seem to be somewhat able to think for themselves on Brexit. So, like, what is it about American news media that fosters this?
There's great reporters, and they can think for themselves. And I think a lot of this story they've gotten a lot of big news and really revealing aspects of this administration. But part of it is just the speed of news right now is so quick. I think it just accelerates the dynamics. That I'm sure the same. I assume those trends are everywhere. But I feel that this weekend was one weekend where the administration aggressively shaped the conversation and everyone went along with it.
Right. So we're talking about, let's see. So what is it now? 3 or 4 days ago, Mueller turned in his report. And since then, the attorney general, a Trump loyalist, said that the president was exonerated. Then the Department of Justice said it wasn't going to defend the Affordable Care Act. And then as we're recording this, on my mind is, I don't know, things are happening at the Supreme Court where a landmark case, two landmark cases in partisan gerrymandering were just heard by the court this morning. And so here we are. It's just, to my thinking, one story after another. And we're just, it's just too hard to keep up.
Well, the Democrats will have to make a decision. It's an important political moment for the party in terms of, do you pursue this investigation? Remember, obstruction was one key basis of the Nixon and Clinton impeachments. And so to say that this report has evidence of obstruction combined with everything we have seen in public, it's a lot for Democrats to say, well, we're not going to continue with this line of inquiry. It's a lot. That's a big decision. But they are at a kind of crossroads between how much do you invest in this and all the other investigations, and how much do you put into an issue-based agenda for the next couple of years to try to win office.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's see. All right, I'm going to get horse racy on you.
Yes.
I really hate this because, you know what I want? I want to live in a world where I get to talk about Medicare cost reimbursements or something, but I'm just going to do horse racy things here. So there's two things that are notable that have also happened in the last week. Mm-hmm. One is something that's been unfolding for a while, which is that there have been a few special elections here and there, and special elections seem to be some kind of metric of where people's temperature is at compared with the last presidential election. And I'm not fully prepared to give a full analysis because there's been too few of these, but the very cloudy picture that's emerging is that Democrats versus Republicans, that margin is not that different from the 2016 race, as opposed to where these special elections were in 2017 and 2018, where they were running something like 9-10 points ahead on average of 2016. And that was an early warning sign of a wave election for Democrats. And so these special elections are unfolding, and I'm watching those. I don't really have good analytics to share at this point, but that's one thing that's on my mind, and it plays into your question of other things that come up besides this Mueller report. There's another thing that came up, and you may have noticed it in the business news, which is that the bond yield curve inverted. And when that curve inverts, in the past, recession has not been too far behind. And if you look at it inverting in March 2019, on average, that means recession about a year later. And a recession in March of 2020 would be adverse for the president's party. So now we've got a couple of things going on here. I just gave you two pieces of information that are somewhat contradictory. But it's all in the spirit of moving away from this Mueller report and saying, okay, what comes next? Talking about the ACA, talking about healthcare reform, whether there's going to be a recession. If we're going to get into that spirit, then I would say that that's, to my thinking, where the playing field is.
And then the other spirit is, A, that the Democratic Party has a responsibility for serious oversight, given everything we have seen from this administration that just doesn't look right, and with a lot of evidence that things weren't right, that a party can't walk away from that. It's just the wrong thing to do.
Yes.
And you can even make a political argument that by doing so, you actually undercut the party, and that this is one of the issues we face right now, corruption, conflict of interest, misuse of presidential power.
Right,
and
right.
I think Democrats can't assume one is politically feasible. The other is probably a mistake. It's hard to game that out.
Right. So if we just get away from gamesmanship and just ask the question, how ought government work? What do we expect from our institutions to make sure that government acts in the interests of the American people, to make sure that the laws are followed, to make sure that our form of government is stable for the future? What that requires is for one branch of government to exercise oversight over another branch of government. And that can be something exciting, like Jared Kushner's texting habits, or it can be something a little bit boring, like investigating practices at the Food and Drug Administration or whatever, or at HUD or whatever it might be. And so normal oversight involves congressional committees doing their job.
Yes. And that is something that you can't, especially with the severity of problems that are out there, just not do. That says a lot about the Democratic Party then.
So climate change hearings, for instance, that would be a thing that, if you look at things that move younger voters, right, they're the ones who have to live in this future a few decades from now. And so they're the ones who care about climate change. So there's a political – okay, so there's – substantively, it's one of the most important things that's going on in our lives.
Yes.
Politically, it's a winner with young voters. And in terms of fiduciary responsibility, it would be a good idea for elected officials to look into it and put it front and center. So, so there we have a convergence of political and substantive importance.
Yes. The other problem, though, is something you talked about when the Trump presidency started on some of these podcasts. You were very concerned about the strength of American political institutions and what all this was saying.
Yes.
If you hit this point, and this weekend is a turning point where oversight falls away, investigation falls away, and accountability is put on the side except for convergence areas. This is then normative, and you, even if he loses in the election of 2020, have kind of said you can do all this stuff, and that's part of American presidential politics at this point. Isn't that problematic?
Yeah, I was thinking about this a little bit. There was, back in the first Gilded Age, there were the mugwumps and there were what eventually became the progressives, people who wanted a better way and who wanted government reforms and had a vision of what could be better. And right now we do seem to be at a turning point where one could imagine something better happening in the future. Let's say one future in which the rule of law becomes important again and these institutions get re-strengthened, whether they be domestic or international. So that's a possibility. Another possibility is that this is the new normal, that it's okay to use the levers of power to suppress wrongdoing. It's okay if you're the president or the attorney general or the Senate majority leader to push things aside and to subvert mechanisms of government. And of course, one of my favorite hobby horses, the fact that we don't seem to have a clear way for the majority to exert its views in the United States, right? Through the House, Senate, the Supreme Court, the presidency. Right. We don't live in a time of majority rule. And so it's a pretty strange and unusual time in American democracy.
And I think my instinct based on nothing other than observing is the president has a serious chance to win re-election in 2020. And I understand conditions can certainly change, like the economy. Depends who the Democratic opponent is. But to discount a very serious possibility for re-election is a mistake in my mind. And this weekend was a huge moment. Again, not because of the report. We don't have it. But the way the report was handled, I think, really boosted his standing.
And yes, I've been very unimpressed with the press. Sometimes they have fine moments. I would say the last 72 hours have not been among those fine moments.
But if there's no accountability and he's reelected in 2020, this will be a transformative presidency, not just in terms of policy, but in terms of what the presidency means and how it can be run. And this weekend could have been a key moment when we look back on it.
Yield curve, baby.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what comes next. Of all the issues, just to wrap up with this, that you think will be most attractive for both parties, for Democrats or Republicans, if you had to pick one issue for each party, what do you think they're going to hone in on? Let's put aside the investigations and oversight. Each party picks an issue. What do you think each one will be thinking about in the next few months?
Well, the Republicans are probably going to be thinking about the politics of resentment, and they're going to find somebody to resent, right? Because it's a brand that works well for them. It seems to be something that's part of their, at the core of their messaging. Is it going to be immigrants? Is it going to be Kamala Harris? Is it going to be government shutdowns or Nancy Pelosi? I think that resentment is a brand that works well for them. And if I were to them, I guess I'd pick, I'd probably try to investigate people who have been going after them and you know, something like that March Madness bracket that Sarah Sanders put out, naming all the reporters. So if I were the Republicans, I'd do that. I don't know. Democrats, what do you think?
Healthcare. I think of all the issues, that's the one.
So at a national stage, yes. What about internally within the Democratic Party?
You mean Medicare for all versus...
Or government reforms. I mean, you know, there seems to be a heck of a policy debate happening within the internal Democratic Party. I would characterize the internal conversation as being a bit of a race to the top where they are all bent on talking about ideas with each other. At least that's my... maybe I'm wrong, but that's my reading.
It's a very enlightened candidate debate so far on both policy and institutions, and I don't know how long that's going to continue. But I still think healthcare as an umbrella issue is just, it's one where there can be serious debate within the party, serious differences,
yes.
But then on the campaign trail, you can draw a pretty clear line with where the Democrats are versus the Republicans.
Yeah.
And on that issue, Democrats are still in an advantage in terms of the polls. So it's just a good issue. You know, the Green New Deal, I also think, is still a good issue to debate. And now today, the day of our recording, Governor Hickenlooper, I think, wrote an op-ed coming out against the Green New Deal, offering a different path for climate change.
Oh,
so,
that's interesting.
But
I think that's a real conversation. That's a policy conversation.
That's exactly right. And I don't know if you're right about Republicans or they'll open up their own conversations. They don't obviously have any primary opponents.
Yeah.
But I think at this point they're pretty overwhelmed and they are now the party of Trump. So I think till 2020, that's all we're going to hear.
So maybe this DOJ Affordable Care Act lawsuit is going to become important to them.
I couldn't believe that's happening the same day. It's, you know, the Bob Barr taketh away from the Democrats and Trump giveth right back with this ACA. That's the last thing the Republicans wanted now.
It does seem like a bit of an own goal.
Yeah, so we'll see. Anyway, we're out of time. So I like the conversation and we'll see by the time this is released, which is in 2 days, if the report is actually official and people can discuss the contents rather than the report on the contents.
Available on Amazon pre-order.
Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Listeners, if you have questions for us, please send them via email, politicspolls@princeton.edu, or you can tweet them at either of us. I'm at Julian Zelizer. Sam, what's your Twitter?
At SamWangPhD. That's my Twitter handle.
Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.